Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Monday edition of the Daily Friend podcast, your source of news and information. I'm Nicholas Larimer, filling in for Big Daddy Liberty, Sihle, again, because unfortunately he is ill at the moment, so I will be filling in for him today and on Wednesday. I am joined by my colleagues here today, our editor-in-chief, Sara Gon. Sara, how are you?
Well, thanks. Hi, Nicholas.
And Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you today?
Fine, thanks. Yourself?
Right, so let's get started. The first thing is there was an article in Report newspaper over the weekend.
Yes.
About the DA and a Miss Phumzile Fandam, the honourable member. Herman, why don't you tell us about what was in that report?
Well, you see, the thing is, Miss Fandam has been a prominent and some would call her controversial member of parliament for the DA for a while now. I personally have had some, you know, Twitter interactions with her. It's no longer an option because she took steps against me in terms of blocking. So she might actually, you know, be superior to most of the Australian batting lineup in the sense that she can block something. But that's my jokes. I'm done now. She a while ago punched someone at the waterfront, acknowledged it, but you know the version of events.
There were conflicting versions of events,
exactly. But then there were other two DA members of parliament, Michael Cardo and Khaled Khachalia, who also who tweeted things out and were accused of breaching the party's social media.
Unrelated to that.
Yes. Apologies. Unrelated to that. So we've got a whole collection of DA MPs kind of in the firing line of the party, two of them for social media reasons, and then Phumzile Fandam was kind of considered, the incident was considered some possibly damage to the reputation of the party, but because the waterfront, who has control over the CCTV footage, wouldn't release it, the party said no, they can't investigate the matter further. And then over the weekend, Khachalia and I think another MP wrote a letter saying that this is really, really inconsistent. The party should apply disciplinary policy across the board, and it now and they threatened to kind of start a petition going if steps weren't taken against Phumzile Fandam. And it seems that these steps now, finally, under this pressure from Khachalia, might now actually be taken. However, Phumzile Fandam disputes this. I saw this from a tweet by Valdimar Pelser. But the thing is that there seems to be, for the first time in a long while, some repercussions for Ms. Fandam's rather, you know, loose cannonish actions.
So, Sara, I'm going to ask you to do that thing that all analysts dread, which is make a prediction. Do you think Phumzile Fandam is actually going to be disciplined, or do you think this is probably going to blow over again?
I don't think she's going. Well, she might be disciplined, but I don't think she'll be found guilty of anything. One obviously worries about the political import of this, but the reality is any organization, like any company, has a disciplinary procedure. And you follow one of the ways you follow the disciplinary procedure, even if it ends up that you find somebody didn't commit something, or you don't have enough evidence to find they committed anything, and if you do find they committed something, you can give them a written warning, or you can dismiss them. Now, this should have been done in the case of Ms. Fandam. I think there's a tendency out there for people to assume that in instances like this, you've got to behave as a court would behave, and that is prove that whatever happened happened beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not like that. It's on the balance of probabilities. And that balance could well be determined just in the process of questioning and cross-questioning.
Especially because, Herman, correct me if I'm wrong, but that standard is usually reserved for serious crimes like murder.
Well, it's in criminal matters, yeah. It's beyond reasonable doubt. In any other matter, it's a balance of probabilities. Mm. But we must say that the balance of probabilities, in if we take her past behavior into account, which objective court might not do, she has been behaving erratically. She has been damaging the party, and I say that from a personal perspective because my support for the party, and I work for the party's election campaign, my support for the party deteriorated partly, because of Phumzile Fandam representing something I think the DA will not find constructive electorally.
Can I just say that from a disciplinary point of view, one of the things you look at is, as you say, past performance. And, I mean, Ms. Fandam has a Twitter history of some substance that could be referred to. Mm. But it all depends how the hearing is conducted.
Yeah, it does seem very strange because the DA has repeatedly put out, because it's had these blow-ups often between its own MPs on Twitter, and the DA has put out these statements and these social media policies that are, it's all its MPs are supposed to adhere to. But Pumzile seems to run by her own.
That's one of the sort of questions that probably won't be answered, and that is, since people have been at least disciplined, if not expelled, but disciplined for less, why hasn't she been? And why won't she be if she won't be?
That's one of the things that really, really confuses me about the DA as it currently is. Why is Phumzile van Dam such a prominent member? I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think she helps the party in any real way. She's a shadow minister. She's a part of the whip team in Parliament. And I'm yet to see a skill that she could bring either to government as a minister or to party discipline as a whip. I mean, it's bizarre. I remember some Twitter spat she and Gwen Gwenya had, where Gwen Gwenya would make a quite neutral statement, and then Phumzile van Dam would interpret that neutral statement as Gwen Gwenya endorsing, for example, I think in this specific instance I'm thinking of, was a tax revolt. Gwen Gwenya said something like, the merit of a tax revolt aside, and then followed up with some reasoning. And then Phumzile van Dam said, oh, so you're saying a tax revolt has merit. And as a disciplinarian for the whip team, I'm not quite sure how she features. And as a shadow minister, I'm yet to be impressed by anything she's done. I've no idea why she's this prominent person within the DEA.
Well, to be fair, and full disclosure, my father's a DEA MP. He was also on the whip team. A lot of what the whips do is not very clearly in the public eye. So I think she does have some influence there. And she is quite a sort of feisty, powerful debater. And arguer. Yeah, we may not agree with her with a lot of
the
viewpoints.
She's feisty, but her arguments are awful.
But she doesn't, when she comes to a fight, she doesn't shy away. She's rumored to be an ally of Mercy, who doesn't necessarily always have that many allies in the party. And so it's...
I'm tempted to ask Mercy who. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, right. Enough bashing the DA, as we do far too often on this podcast.
If we look at this and nothing happens, what will be the consequence for the party as objectively?
Well, I think presumably failure to act on this is going to only further. Firstly, it's going to isolate the factions of the DA who are taking this to the party hierarchy. And it's also going to incense voters who are already put off by her. As we've seen,
myself as an example.
The Hermans of the world are being put off by her inflammatory remarks.
Cool. Yeah, can I perhaps say the last word on the matter? And that is the fact that the DA saw fit to discipline somebody like Michael Carter, who's a formidable intellect, and doesn't tweet irresponsibly. Shall I say, or generally, I haven't read any responsible tweet. This is going to be, in a way, an acid test for the DA.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, so let's move on to something a bit less exciting and a bit more depressing, which is people leaving the country. Sarah, why don't you tell us about that?
I just saw a little item that actually confirmed what people have been sort of talking about over dinner party tables, and that is that there's been a huge spike in inquiries for emigration from South Africans to go to places like particularly New Zealand, Australia, the US, Portugal. Portugal's become actually very popular, and Canada. And one consultancy, the Nduku Consulting Group, has reported that the requests for information have gone from an average of 2 per week to 20 per day.
That's quite shocking, actually.
It's very shocking. And it's the sort of figure that the government should be taking a note of, particularly because the advice also is that the majority of people leaving or inquiring to leave are black. And everyone has assumed that they are white.
And really hits home. I come from a family. We've enjoyed the fruits, I think, of a new South Africa, and we're quite loyal. generally, but I'm hearing for the first time in my life the sounds of alternative plans being made. Real fear. People who have never been alarmists, who have never been part of, you know, they are coming for us, we need to verschammel some lucky scores. These are people who have genuinely embraced a new democratic dispensation and love this country dearly. And most of them, ironically enough, don't want to leave this continent.
Yeah.
But other plans are, you know, being considered for the first time. And it's really hit home in the last month or two.
My impression from this, and it's one could have told the government, you know, fairly simply, as soon as you start interfering with people's medical care and threaten to interfere with their pension funds, you really scare people. And I agree with you. I mean, people who've the people we know have emigrated a long time ago. This is the first era in which I agree with you. You see people considering leaving who you never thought would leave. Mm. Now, if they do, as I know Panyaza Lesufi has said, they want to consider banning private education, the country will just empty out of professionals.
Yes. Very well put.
And taxpayers.
I think one of the central issues here is that there's a sort of mainstream narrative about South Africa's emigration has been that this is disgruntled whites leaving because they're no longer enjoying the benefits of apartheid, and they're leaving in disgust because things are no longer so easy for them. But the fact that most of these emigrants are black suggests that the fact that our economy isn't growing is really hurting everyone. Mm. There is no racial dynamic of this has been way overplayed, and that when the country isn't growing, everyone suffers, not just the white middle class.
There was an interview a few weeks ago on the subject on Carte Blanche, I think, and I just caught a bit of it, but they were interviewing a young black lady who'd emigrated to Australia. And I think Derek Watts asked her, you know, if things improved, would she come back? And she said, never, at least I'm secure here, and et cetera, et cetera. And the bottom line is it proves that race is much less an issue than class.
Mm. Mm. Well said. Okay, but we've got, as people leave, we've got some new people coming in. The IFP has finally elected, I think, its second ever president. I may be wrong, but I believe that that's correct. As Mangosuthu Buthelezi steps down from leadership of the IFP, and he's been replaced with a new contender, Sara?
Yes, apparently a gentleman by the name of Velenkosine Shlabizi. Apparently he was a school principal. He's in his early 50s.
So very young for the IFP.
Yes, absolutely.
IFP leadership standards.
40, he's got 40 years still to make up. But his goals are to bridge divisions within the party, which is probably no bad thing. But he will fight not to scrap the Ingonyama Trust Board. Now, as I understand, the Ingonyama Trust Board, the Ingonyama Trust, which owns a goodly chunk of KwaZulu-Natal, the only board member is the Zulu King. But I'm so they are, in other words, they are going to really take on that element of the new report by the Land Commission that wants the trust dissolved so that people, you know, individual ordinary people can own the land they're on in KZN and not be ruled as, I suppose, almost like serfs in the context of the king. So that seems to be our new...
A bit of illiberalism there, but I believe, according to our colleague Sifle, they've also adopted a resolution to fight against socialism.
Yes. Yes, and that's promising. And I was just about to say that we might be entering a period of some very strange bedfellows where liberals like ourselves might find allies in, you know, the Zulu nationalists who want to protect the Ingonyama Trust, and together we might present some opposition to expropriation without compensation. I don't know. It would make me very uncomfortable, I think, to, you know, advocate on the one hand for personal property ownership, individual title deeds, and so on, while on the other hand fighting for a feudal right to own land. So that will. But we are heading into times where you will find strange bedfellows, because what we really see now is principles are at stake, fundamental principles are at the stake, and under those circumstances some real odd alliances emerge. And well, I mean, a motion against socialism, that's wonderful. Support for feudal land ownership, less so. We'll have to see how it goes. We'll have to see if he can grow the party at all. It would be exciting if he can, We'll see.
Yeah, one is struck by the potential of the IFP. It's got this solid base of support in a sort of local region, and like the DA grew from the Western Cape to expand itself until it's hit its current troubled waters, one suspects that there's a lot of potential that they could reach the 10% that they got in 1994 and perhaps go further. But the IFP has always suffered from this problem that they had a lack of strong characters outside of KZN and outside of Buthelezi. So he's really got a lot of work ahead of him if he's going to get through this.
And I don't at this stage, I hope to learn more in the near future, but I don't at this stage know what type of person he is, to what extent he will operate best within the KZN milieu or whether he will be able to spread further. But, you know, he's representing a province that has a very largely conservative population, and I think the IFP can tap into that. And fighting socialism, I suspect he can probably tap into that too.
But it's also a very dangerous job, as we know. South Africa's political scene in KZN is very dangerous. A lot of assassinations continue, not just between political parties, but within political parties. I think the most dramatic of that was, do you remember a few years ago when I think it was an NFP or an IFP councillor was shot outside of a courtroom while he was on trial for a murder himself? So it's not a position I'd want to have president of the IFP.
I must say it's interesting because the he has one of two, I think, as I see it, options in getting the IFP to be relevant again. One, he could create a conservative party, a non-racial conservative party opposed to socialism, but very much tapping into the inherent conservatism.
Up standards in school, beat school children again.
That typical thing that South Africans, largely Christian population, will like, that, you know, kind of Calvinistic stripe that is really present in the population as a whole. So that's one option. The other option, he could become a nationalist, a Zulu nationalist street fighter.
And try to take back KZN.
So he can try and position himself as a new face of conservatism, or he can be a street fighter and take part in the ugly game that is Zulu politics. So, I mean, those are basically his two options. I can't see another.
Yeah, I think if he goes the former option, he could look at the areas as they did pre-negotiations, and that's Gauteng, what is now Gauteng, and the Zulu presence here. Now, that would have the ramifications of history might be unpleasant, but there is that distinctly large presence.
The IFP, I believe, is one of the only parties that actually wins awards in Johannesburg that is not the ANC or the DA. There is a hostile ward that I think the ANC won is in the last election, but it's very close, and it's been won by the IFP in the past. So
that they could really, you know, KZN aside, if they really strategically aimed at Gauteng, they could make a difference, particularly in this sort of era of disillusion.
And an era of resurgence for the Freedom Front Plus. I mean, they aren't natural bedfellows, but they are bedfellows to a certain extent.
Well, they're both nationalists.
Yeah. They are both tribal nationalists, and they are both strongly conservative. So if they can build a common ground on that, it might alter the political dynamics of the game a bit.
It feels a little bit distressingly like 1993 again.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
Exactly. But
moving on. So we had this last week. We've written about it a bit on the Daily Friend. But it seems like, as the IRA has been saying for a while, prescribed assets look like they are coming down. President Cyril Ramaphosa was asked a question directly by the DA in Parliament. They said, are prescribed assets going to be implemented by the government? And Ramaphosa went, Kosatu likes it.
Yes.
So, Herman, what's your take on all of this?
Well, I'm trying to earn more so that I can afford alcoholism. But the problem is...
Oh, way ahead of you, buddy.
the thing about prescribed assets is a very, very, very safe-sounding neutral term for what is essentially the looting of nest eggs. Mm. We have to, that's the first thing that people have to be clear about. And the second thing is, this isn't alarmism. This isn't the IRR looking for some kind of current of worry and fear politics that we can tap into to grow our supporters. This is genuinely something that is coming down the pipeline, and it is coming at us fast. The president was asked, do you support the raiding of people's pensions to bail out a state that cannot manage its own affairs? And the president said, oh, the conversation must be had, and it has worked in the past. In the very same parliamentary session that President Ramaphosa said, we have to attract investment, we have to attract investment, we have to attract investment, he then swerves full communist, full socialism, and says, oh, You know the money that our people worked for many years, that they hope to live out their last days on? Yeah, that we could use to fund the state utopia we want to build, or, as the other half of the ANC might hope, to loot. So it's worrying that the president didn't say no, but we didn't expect him to say no.
I think people have generally not paid enough attention to the extent to which Ramaphosa will contradict himself in one speech. Yes. That's only when there tends to be, oh, we want investment, but we're gonna take your pension.
We want expropriation without compensation, but oh, food security and property rights.
And you never know which way he's going, except you can assume, because he's a socialist, he's going to actually end up in the socialist, making a socialist decision. But going for requiring pension funds to invest a certain proportion of a fund in prescribed assets, which in the old days were things like SOEs, and usually SOEs, in this case just spells disaster given the state of our SOEs. But it's really the trifecta. It's prescribed assets, expropriation without compensation, and NHR.
Yes.
I mean, if you want to decimate the professional population in the sense of immigration, and you want to absolutely ensure there's nothing but capital outflows and no investment in, that's your trifecta.
I mean, that's the perfect storm. Really, if you want to chase investors, those are the three things you do, and he's doing that.
I think the other mistake the government is making here, beyond the sort of larger mistakes of driving the country down this sort of very short-term road, is that if you tighten the screws too much on businesses and individuals, they're going to actually start opting out of the system entirely.
Yeah.
The amount of tax evasion and rule breaking that will probably follow a very strict policy of something like prescribed assets is going to be very high. So if the government is trying to at least salvage its financial situation in the short term, I think it's going to get less money than it thinks it will.
Mm. And this really goes back to what we said earlier in the podcast. Every person that emigrates is someone who can afford to emigrate. That means it's someone who probably could afford to pay tax. We're losing taxpayers at an alarming rate.
Well, there was just one other fact about the immigration that I saw and I forgot to mention, is that for every one professional immigrating, eight are emigrating. So there you have it.
No, we have serious issues facing us at the moment. If you'd like to support the IRR's fight against prescribed assets, you can SMS your name to 32823 and to support our work in continuing to push out information about this policy and why it's a bad idea and exactly why the government should abandon it. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of the Daily Friend podcast, and we'll see you on Wednesday.